the perspective of Chazal on a sefer in Tanakh is illuminating. They saw the Sifrei HaTanakh with a different depth, a different analysis than we see. Chazal, the Gemara states in Shabbos, that Bikshu Livnoi Sefer Kehelas, the Gemara writes in Bava Madli. They wish to take Megillas Kehelas and to hide it. Except that they noted that Chiloso Yerushalayim and Sefer Yerushalayim, so they felt it was worthy of being kept as part of Sifrei HaKadosh. Rashi adds, but that concern is not Chazal's perspective on Sefer Kehelas. But Rashi comments, what does it help if Chiloso is Yerushalayim and Sofer is Yerushalayim? But if the basic text of the Sefer itself lacks merit, so it has a good opening and a good closing. There are a lot of books in the world that people wrote very good prefaces for, very good epilogues, but there's not much in between the covers. So Rashi, in his commentary on Masechta Shabbos, tells us, Kol Shekein Emtzei Iso, and certainly the body of the text itself. Meaning, if thematically the preface tells me that this is a Sefer of Yerushalayim and the summation is of Yerushalayim, then obviously the text of the Sefer itself deals with Yerushalayim. So that's a perspective Rashi teaches us, and how Chazal looked at a Sefer by seeing the prologue and the epilogue that defines the body of the Sefer itself. The very fascinating Chazal in Masechta the Megillah, which refers directly to the very beginning and the very end of Megillas Esther. Rab Chanina Omar, the question is there any allusion in the name of Ahasuerus? At least in the Hebraic version of his name, is there an allusion as well? The more often varied allusions. What? No, allusions to events or perspectives. For example, the Gemara tells us, Shmuel Omar, Shehushkuru Pneyam Shal Yisrael, that he darkened the face of the Jews in his time. It was a dark and difficult era for the Jews. It's one perspective. So Ahasuerus alludes to Hushkar, to darken. Rabbi Yochanan offers a different perspective. Anyone that mentions his name said, "Oh, woe unto me." Yet Rabbi Chanina Omar Shakol Nasin Reishin Biyomo. Everyone became impoverished in his time. Shenema, and he goes to the very end of the Megillah. Vayosam Hamelech Achashverosh Mas. He placed tribute. He exacted tribute. And he concludes, Hu Achashverosh, when it says Hu Achashverosh Hu Berishon Mitchiloso Vatzofo, he was evil throughout. Chazal observed the Hakdomo by Yehi B'mei Achashverosh, and they tied it directly to the end, Vayosam Hamelech Achashverosh Mas. And in the next words, Hu Achashverosh, he was evil throughout. That's what the words Hu Achashverosh tell us. But what is the perspective that Chazal have? Approaching it from the perspective that Rashi and Masechta Shabbos gives us, if we see the beginning and we see the end that reflects upon the tochen, the basic content, Achashverosh was a person that was concerned with money. And therefore, Shakol Nasin Reish B'yomov, his taxes were off the charts. And where do we see this? It quotes the very end of the Megillah, Vayosam HaMelech Achashverosh Mas Al Oretz B'yayam. He was a person who was concerned with exacting tribute, with building his personal wealth. There are those that interpret the very last chapter in the Megillah is a very mysterious chapter. It seems really not to tell us much in the way of the story. Haman has departed from the scene. Ahasuerus has risen to greatness. Esther has enacted Purim. What do we need the 10th parak for? And its references are equally obscured. If you want to know of the greatness of Mordechai, well, we'll send you to the library. Look it up on the internet. They're recorded in the royal archives of Malchei Modei Ephoros. Doesn't do any of us much good. The 10th parak, there's a lot to be said about the 10th parak, but the 10th parak seems to lack toichen, any substance. One perspective on the 10th parak is that it showed how Mordechai maintained power in the world. That's one perspective that's offered. He understood Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus had one concern: money, power. And therefore, in his era as prime minister, is Vayosam HaMelech Ahasuerus Masal Oretz V'Yayayom. He knew how to keep the bureaucracy of the king functioning for the particular agenda that the king had. And for what reason? Mordechai's reason was not the aggrandizement of the king, but rather he wished to be in a position to protect the Jewish people in the Persian Empire. And therefore, he needed a very keen political eye to understand what would assure his stability in power. And he realized if he served the central need of Ahasuerus, the heir to his wealth, then he was going to have a very secure position, one of extreme longevity. And thus he involves himself. The Megillah ends. It's a perspective, a political perspective on Golus, that if we are to survive in Golus, we have to well understand what the power centers of the society that we live in, what their goals are. And to the extent that we're able to ally ourselves with those goals, we will find a certain tranquility and stability. That's a perspective. So Ahasuerus is a person who seeks great wealth. The Malbim tells us, it's very interesting, at the very beginning of the Megillah is the only time we find Vayhibim Ahasuerus or Ahasuerus. Every other time is referred to always as HaMelech Ahasuerus. Here, he has no title of Melech at the very beginning. And the Malbim tells us the reason for this is that Ahasuerus was not a descendant of the royal family of Persia. He was a person who seized the moment. He had certain wealth, and people respected him for it, and he used it as a lever to achieve power. But he had a major concern, and I'm really shocked that a 19th century Eastern European figure like the Malbim so understood the political world as it exists in the 19th and 20th centuries. Says that there are two types of kings in the world. And we know that's a perspective that Chazal shared with us. Is one king who governs by consent of the people. That's one type of king. There's a second king who doesn't govern by consent. He governs by seizing power. He's powerful. He's a powerful army. He's powerful allies. And he seizes control of society. Ahasuerus, the Malbim tells us, initially gains power because people turn to him. They feel a man of his stature, of his wealth, should lead them. But Ahasuerus' concern is to convert the power that has been bestowed upon him by others into dictatorial power. And he gives a very careful analysis of the difference between a king who is of the people and by the people, and one who is a dictator. And he says, and it's so strange, this is what we saw just in the last year's play out in Iraq. If he's appointed by the people, then the king has his wealth, and the national treasury is something else. If he seizes power, then his treasury and the national treasury in time become one and the same. We merely have to turn to recent events of the last few years in Iraq to see how clear a perspective this is. Ahasuerus wished to have absolute power and not be limited. And this would enhance his wealth greatly, because the entire wealth of the Persian Empire would become his. He was a person who was focused on wealth and power. And he says this is the context of the Megillah. And it's frightening because it's really the study of Jewish history and all the generations, if we analyze it carefully. He says, what was he concerned with? He wanted to establish his independence. Now, he used varied means to assert himself. He goes in the first parak of the Megillah with some very, very interesting insights. The Megillah tells us those that were involved in the party Shnasholosh Lumolchoi. This is the third year that he was in power. Also Mishtel Cholsorov Abodov, Chel Poras of Modai, Apartamin, Visorei Hamadino Islefonov. He called his Sorov, meaning those that had the closest association with him, Avodov, his servants, Chel Poras of Modai, members of the military establishment. But Visorei Hamadinos Lefonov. It's very strange. The last one on this list is Sorei Hamadinos. This should have been the first one on the list. The ones that ruled over, you know, 127 Medinas. The ones that ruled those Medinas, those were the most powerful people in the empire. But he says that the very meaning of Visorei Hamadinos, what does the word Lefonov mean, the Malbim tells us? The word Lefonov means that these were the power brokers until now. Before Ahasuerus' time, these were the power brokers. What was Ahasuerus' interest? He wanted to put them down. So what did he do? He wanted to show that his personal circle, the ones that had been least powerful until now, but their claim to fame was their association with Ahasuerus, these are the ones that will have the first rank in the kingdom. So therefore, those that his associates, even though of lesser stature in the empire, were given first billing. Visorei Hamadinos Lefonov, and those that had been Visorei Hamadinos until his time, they were pushed to the background. And he says, this lied behind the fact, if there are 180 days of revelry, a half year of revelry, then he opens a party, irrespective of stature, great, small, in the royal courtyards. And this party certainly did not hold, take second billing to anything. I mean, if we just note, it's the description, Mito Zahava Kesef. The beds, their style of eating was, as we know what the Seder was, to recline. So they didn't give a wooden bed or a straw bed, which a commoner would use. But every commoner was given a gold and silver bed. I mean, the king couldn't live better than this. And this, every citizen of Shushan Abira was given this. Linen floors, linen floorings, v'hashkleis b'chleizov, abundant golden kelim, v'chelim v'chelim shonim, every type of utensil that one could want, v'yein malchus, and the royal wines, rof k'yar ha-melech. What was his purpose? The Malbim tells us. His purpose was that he wished to show his that he was the ultimate power. So what did he do? He said, the people of Shushan, the commoners of Shushan, are as worthy of being in the palace as the Sarei HaMedinas, as the political heads of all the countries over which he ruled. And he did this not so much to build up the common citizens, but rather to put down the nobility. That you're no more important to me than the commoners that live in Shushan Abira. So therefore, after 180 days of revelry, what does he do? He opens up the palace and he invites every single citizen of Shushan to come and treats them grandly. You could not treat a king in better fashion, to show that in his eyes, they're as worthy as all the royalty, all the nobility that were here until now. To display his independence of them. Now, it goes back to the second pasuk in the Megillah. Bayomim ahem kishabat hamalach Achashverosh al kisei malchus asher b'shushan abira. He observes that we find in Tanakh that Shushan was not historically the seat of government. Elam. Shushan was not the seat of power on which previous kings of Persia had built their palace. Now normally, a person that wants a certain legitimacy, if you become the leader of Russia, so you seek to put your office in the Kremlin. Because this is the seat of power. But Ahasuerus did not want to be associated with the power that came before. The power that came before was merely a stepping stone for him to seize absolute power. And therefore, it became imperative for him, Rishnas, Bayomim Kishevis HaMelech HaChashverosh, and as Rashi translates, what's Kishevis? Kishenizkayim HaMalchus Biyodo. Once he became secure in the position, now it was time to move. And this is Al-Kiseh Malchus HaAsher B'Shushan Avira. He comes, that's it. We're leaving Moscow. We're leaving Washington. We're moving the capital to Kansas City. To show that whatever came before is irrelevant. The whole political order that existed until now, may have existed for generations and before, it's all null and void. There are new power centers. New people are important. Old people are unimportant. And thus he moves the capital to Shushan Abira. Now this, he says, leads directly to the difficulties that he has with Vashti. Vashti was a marriage of convenience for him. Why? Because Vashti had a legitimate claim to the throne. She was a granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So, in his early years of gathering power, it was worth his while to marry Vashti, because those that respected the dynasty that came before, now he was tied to the royal blood, and at least in the schus of his wife, he was worthy of being the king of Persia. But this in the long run proves to be an impediment to him. It helped him to secure power. But he does not want to be bound by the past. And therefore, he seeks to humble Vashti. And he calls Vashti, in fact, to come to him. She's not able to. Vashti, as a power broker, who should have attended her party? The most powerful people in Persia. But what does he reduce her to? Mishtei Noshim. The powerless in society, the women who can have no power in such a society, then those that want, Gam Vashti Amalka also said Mishtei Noshim. Her party is for the powerless. The powerful don't come to her party. Achashverosh wishes to demonstrate that the power belongs to him. And even calling her to come to him, even the title that she's given, is Lahobias Vashti Hamalka, he notes. Achashverosh we call throughout the Megillah Hamelech Achashverosh. Never Achashverosh Hamelech. And yet here we find Vatumayim, here we find Lahobias Vashti Hamalka. Her response is Vatumayim Hamalka Vashti. Here we find Malka Vashti first. And this is just the essence of what took place. He wished to show that she was Vashti. The fact that she's a Malka is because of her association with him. She's married to the king. She's not the Malka. It's Ashes HaMelech. And this is exactly the reason she understood what he wanted. Is Vatumayim HaMalka Vashti. She asserted herself as the Malka. Legitimacy in this government lies with me. And this is the problem that he faces. And we can well understand then why he is willing to accept that the resolution of his issue with Vashti is to put her to death. She's out of the way, and he's asserted his absolute authority. And it's a story of Byzantine politics, one that those that have studied world history and the history of despotic states have learned many, many times over. And we're not surprised with that Acharad Boram Gidal HaMelech HaKashverosh was Haman ben Hamadosa. Who was this Haman? Chazal tell us. Was a barber. We find common laborers in Saddam Hussein's Iraq became from the most powerful people in the state. Common laborers, not particularly learned people, not technocrats, but common laborers. We're not surprised in that context of the rise of a Haman. Gidal HaMelech is Haman ben Hamadasa. Why? Exactly for the reason that it comes from outside the sources of power. To take a real power broker and make him prime minister, then he is dealing with the power that exists. He wishes to override and trump all power that exists. So he takes a person that has no loyalty to any political center. He's not for the political caste at all of the country. He's about as low down on the social scale as he could possibly be. Now, such a person is certainly going to be filled with himself when he comes to power. He's certainly going to be loyal to the king because the king has given him everything. And he will have no impediment to carrying out his designs. Now Haman goes about it as he pushes his position to the hilt. And he understood political chicanery very well. Everyone bows down to him. It's as I said, we read of the world today, of the Middle East, and the same overtones. Haman, Chazal tell us, the Gemara asks in Megillah, what's the reason that the Jews of Persia want to be condemned? Why did this great sorrow of Haman come in the first place? So the first answer that Chazal give is that they attended the party of Achashverosh. They used the kingdom of the Beis HaMikdash. They degraded themselves by being involved in this party. But as true as that is, but Chazal raised an objection to this as the absolute answer to the question. Why? Because they said this only affected Ayyudim Asher B'Shushan. Only the Jews of Shushan attended this party. The Jews throughout the vast reaches of the empire, they were not invited to this party. The royalty from throughout the empire and the citizens of Shushan. So there were Jews among the citizens of Shushan, so they also attended the party. But the rest of the Jews throughout the empire, the greatest preponderance of them, they were not guilty of participating in this. So Chazal tell us, Tachavu the Tzelem, Haman wore a Tzelem, a religious sign. And when you bow down to him, you are giving honor not only to Haman, as it were, but to the religious sign as well. And that's why Mordechai, why does Mordechai resist bowing down to him, Chazal tell us? Not because he couldn't humble himself to him. Chazal, to the contrary, of derived from Yaakov Avinu, that if someone has power, that Yaakov bowed down many times to Esau. But he wore a tzelem. And the fact that we bow down before a tzelem, this fact already is with a touch and some measure of Avodah Zarah. So what do we have with Haman? To put him in perspective, Haman is a person that he has political power, but what does he do with his political power? He ties his political power together with religious overtones. We watch everything that goes on in Palestinian society and all the terror that exists in the world. You watch it wrapped in a religious cloak. Haman is that first character that we have in Tanakh, apparently. Or a very prominent character. That did it. This was exactly his mode of operation. Not only political power, but he tied it to respect for religion as well. And the difficulty that Mordechai has with him, as a politician, he could have dealt with him. But why does he refuse to bow? Because he gives religious trappings to himself. And Mordechai feels it's a violation of the laws of Avodah Zarah at this point. Now, what do we find? What's his response? Very interesting response. And that's why I say he understood political machinations very, very well. He states the following. Vayimoleh Haman chema. He became extremely angry. Someone dares to slight him? And not even a member of the real political elite of Persia? That would have been bad enough. But some Jew, some foreigner? Vayivesh be'enov. It was beneath his dignity. The shloach yod b'mordechai lebado. Ki yegidu lo was am Mordechai. Because they told him of the nation of Mordechai. Vayivakesh Haman, Haman sought. Lashmiras kol ha'yehudim. Destroy all the Jews. Asher b'chol malchus ha'chashverosh am Mordechai. What exactly? How does one read this pasuk? Very, very difficult to put this pasuk together. Vayivesh be'enov. It was beneath his dignity. The shloach yod b'mordechai lebado. Ki yegidu lo, because they told him the nation, and therefore yivakesh Haman lahashmit. It's the sequence of events that takes place in this book. Very hard to understand. but Haman had a very good political sense. His objective was to eliminate Mordechai, that's true. But he did not want it to, from a political standpoint, to be so obvious. He did not want it to be perceived that he's using his power to settle personal scores. To deal with Mordechai, that's a personal score. He's disrespected him, so he wants to put him to death. But Haman has grander designs than that. What does he want to do? He wants to be a big hero of the state. Under that guise, he will settle his personal scores. So he realizes, Ki yigidu lo es am Mordechai. He realized he had a different possible means of resolving the problem. If he had no other means, he would have dealt with Mordechai straight out. And whatever the consequences politically were of it, he would have done. But once he realized that he had an entirely different avenue of settling a score with Mordechai, his vayivah ba'inav, it was beneath his dignity to deal with it head on with Mordechai himself. Ki yigidu lo es am Mordechai. Mordechai is a Jew. With the Jews, he realized he could go to Achashverosh and tell him, give him a whole story. Yeshno am echad mefuzan refer ben ha'amim mechol medino es malchusecho. And he knew how to put it across in a way which was devastating. He says, the contempt for the king, what a Chazal tell us, if a fly falls into the cup of wine, what do they do with it? They throw the fly out and they drink it. If the king touches the wine, they spill it down the drain. He knew how to rile them up. Now, we've always suffered from the problem that we are mafusa and mafurat min amin. We're a small people. We're spread out. We are not, don't look politically significant and consequential. One of the 127 Medinas over which he ruled, to come to the conclusion, to wipe it off the face of the earth, it's not so simple. It's a part of the empire. Am I going to wipe it off? Am I going to destroy part of the empire? That would certainly need a great deal of thought. If he had enemies in one part of the empire, so he would deal with his enemies. But does he want to destroy an entire part of the empire? But Haman tells him, there's no problem. They're b'chol medinos ma'chusecha. They're here, whatever. You can eliminate the Jews and society will go on. Every single part of society will continue to function. We'll just get rid of them. And as it is, there are strange people. They are distinct from every other people in the world. And they don't ultimately respect the king's religion, the king's edicts. Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, in a very striking story, says that there was a frum yid that lived, that had a summer home in Cape Cod. And I guess this was before that Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal organized the shul that takes place there during the summer months. There was no shul. So there were frum Jews that went, this was their summer resort. So a man came to him, a non-Jewish person, knocked on the house of his next door neighbor one Sunday morning, and he says to him, Mr. Cohen, or whatever his name was, he knew he was a religious Jewish man, and he said, I'd like to invite you to come to the service together with me, to my church this morning. You know, you don't have a synagogue here on the Cape, so I'm inviting you to come with me to share in the religious service. He says, what is the perspective of the non-Jewish world? The non-Jewish world can fathom all types of denominations. So in the non-Jewish world, if someone is a Presbyterian and one's an Episcopalian, no, so lechatchila you go to your denomination. Oh, but what's that mshas adchak if they don't have one of your denomination around? Listen, could be Yaitzi with the Yevet, you know, with one of the other ones. And a Episcopalian, a Presbyterian. So the non-Jew, he understood that the man next door to him is a religious person. But he related to it the same way. What happened if he had a Christian neighbor that didn't have his denomination church in? A Protestant that didn't have his denomination on the Cape. He would have knocked on him and he would have been a very good neighbor and invited him to attend the religious services together with me. I'm inviting you to come to my church together with me as my guest. Their perspective on us is, we're just, you know, there's three Jewish denominations. That's all. There's another few denominations in the world. That we are Doseim Shainais Mikolom. That we are an entirely different people with an entirely different perspective on life and a totally different religious agenda. Haman understood it. The world does not. And he said, it's that which the world will never forgive us for. He said, in all the times that he went to deal in the academic circles of Boston, in Harvard and MIT, back in the 40s, early 50s, and he would go to ask that they make special arrangements for the Jewish students so that they shouldn't have to have the problems of missing exams and Shabbos and Yom Tov. He says, what was the big difficulty for them to hire one proctor for 2 hours to give an exam to some other time? He says, that wasn't the problem. The essential problem that they has is, why in the world are you people different? He says, they could not digest that. In academia in Boston, not the street people, the academics, the leaders of academia in Boston. It's what they couldn't digest. Why are you people different? Why do you have to be different than everyone else? And this is Haman. V'doseim shayinais mikolom. Different than everyone else in the world. When I was a young child, I used to go to yeshiva in Chaim Berlin. And it was quite distant from my house where I lived. I lived in East New York. Everyone knows that. We lived together. And it was probably about 2.5 miles or so, you know, to Brownsville, the Eastern Parkway, and Prosper East, where Chaim Berlin was. And I had to take a bus and walk a few blocks to get to the yeshiva. It took a half an hour, 40 minutes each day, each way. And you met all types of people on the bus. In the morning, as I got on the bus, you know, the same people get on every day. There were the fellows that went to Yeshiva Torah Chaim in East New York, so they got on the bus. And after about 12, 13 blocks after I got on the old, that's it. They came to Yeshiva and I got off, and I had forever to go yet. So there was one fellow on the bus. I don't remember his ethnic background. I still relatively remember what he looked like. He was a Christian, Catholic. And I used to meet him every single day on the bus. So one day, I guess it was Friday, I believe it was a Friday, so he made a mistake. And in those days, they didn't eat meat on Fridays, the Catholics. So he brought along a meat sandwich by mistake. So basically, you know, he said the Lord will forgive him, they'll get a dispensation, whatever. It's not good, you know. Listen, you know, you gotta eat kosher, that's true. But, so machtze chamol, once in a while it happens, listen, what can you do? The only restaurant in town is McDonald's. What are you gonna do? Just, you know? A guy should come for state, that's all. Listen, it's Friday. It's all right. You know, the galach, I'll give you a brocha, a mechila, and you'll be fine. That it's inflexible and unbent. No non-Jew can relate to this. How could it be? What is this? Doseim shayna is mikolom. V'sdosei ha-melech einam oisim, v'la-melech imshay v'la-hanicham. They respect their own religion more than anything else in society. So Haman uses this for one end, that he will create a political agenda to wipe an entire people off the face of the earth. But for what reason? He has no issue with the Jewish people in and of themselves. Nothing to do with the Jews. To the contrary, Chazal tell us that the Jews bowed down to him. They were shtachavah to tell him. And that was our difficulty. We should not have bowed down. We didn't resist him and what he stood for. The entire thing was a political ploy. It wiped the Jews off the face of the earth. For what reason? because he wants to kill Mordechai. And it's more in keeping with his dignity to kill a few million people. And in the midst of all of that, Mordechai will meet his fate as part of a mass pogrom. That's a political undertaking. Strengthen the king's hand to deal with political problems in the country. That's Vayives Ba'inov. This is the perspective of Soina Yisrael B'chol Dor V'Dor. There doesn't have to be a reason that we've aggrieved them, that we've insulted them. The Jews of Persia were very involved in society. To the contrary, that was our biggest fault in Persia. It's how involved in society we became. The Gemara tells us, Ad Yavar Amcho Hashem, Ad Yavar Amzuko Niso. The Gemara Brochus tells us that these two Ad Yavars, the first one refers to Klal Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim and going to Eretz Yisrael. The second Ad Yavar refers to Klal Yisrael leaving Bavel, the second coming, to establish the second Jewish commonwealth and coming to Eretz Yisrael. Shas tells us that just as the first one was with Nisan Gluyim, B'yod Romo, the coming of the Jews to build the second Jewish commonwealth should equally have been with Nisan Gluyim. And yet we know it was very humble beginnings. We started to build the Beis HaMikdash, we were stopped, we started again, etc. We did not have full political independence. It was a very tortured existence. Only a minority of the Jews returned from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. So the Gemara says, why is this? The Gemara says, Ela Shagora Machet. We were guilty of a chet, of chet. We were unworthy. But the Gemara doesn't tell us what was the chet. What chet? General religious malaise is what? Ramei Simcha. The Meshech Chochma, Parshas Bo tells us. What was the chet in Bavel? The chet in Bavel was how much we entered society, how much we assimilated into society. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people married Persian wives. What do we find with Ezra? He gets 42,000 people who are basic religious people, except married to non-Jewish wives. And he's able to appeal to them as people of religion, just to leave the shiksas behind, and let's all go, we're going to march off to Eretz Yisrael. So tens of thousands of Jews, thousands, who knows how many thousands, married non-Jews. We were deeply integrated, too integrated into Persian society. And he notes in a phenomenal piece in Parshas Bo, that in the Golas, he says, oftentimes the Rabbeinu Shel Olam places greater emphasis on those things which are mavdil us, which separate us from Umas Olam, from the non-Jews of the world, than on Gufay Mitzvahs, than even on major mitzvahs of the Torah itself. In Mitzrayim, the Gemara says, it's the Gemara in Megillah, the Malachim said, I'll all the way the Avodah Zarah. Chazal state, Halolu of the Avodah Zarah, Halolu of the Avodah Zarah. We were right in the Avodah Zarah in Mitzrayim. Bris Milah lapsed. At the very end of Golas Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu was to come, Vayimelech b'damaya chayi, Vayimelech b'damaya chayi, to give us two mitzvahs. Bris Milah and Korban Pesach, because Bris Milah was not performed. Certainly a major violation of the Torah. And yet, in Golas Mitzrayim, we were worthy of Nisan. For what reason? Because we maintained our ethnicity. What did we maintain? Loshino Lishoino. We had a uniquely Jewish language. Loshino Malbusha, a uniquely Jewish mode of dress. Loshino Vashmom. The names were Jewish names. In an ethnic sense, we maintained ourselves as a people. Chazal tell us there was zero intermarriage in Mitzrayim. Nobody married a Mitzrayim. Right? One parsha that there was an illegitimate liaison in Chazal Shlomis Basdivri, the Torah talks about it. Didn't exist. And there in Golis we were worthy, the Ramei Simcha says, that the Rabbanu Shalom took us out biyot chazoka, biyot romo, biyot chazoka. In Golis Bovo, where the people were basically were from, they maintained the Torah. But the ethnic divide, we did not maintain. Then we were unworthy. The Rabbanu Shalom needs to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. That is a major lesson that we have to learn. And sometimes that runs exactly counter to that which we see. Haman's appeal was, Yeshno Am Echad Mefuzer Mefer Ben Amin Mechol Medinas Malchusecha. He attacked us because we are different. But yet why did we suffer because of it? Exactly because we really did not maintain ourselves in an appropriate fashion as Yeshno Am Echad with Doseim Shainas Mekolom. To end, there's a very striking Taras Kayanim. Torah writes, Kumash Vayikra, Ba'abdil Eskrim and Amim Lios Lilaham. I will separate you from the nations of the world, Lios Lilaham. The Taras Kayanim tells us in a very striking statement. If you keep yourself separate from the nations of the world, then you belong to me, the Rabbanu Shalom says, you are mine. The imlav, and if not, you will fall into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and similar tyrants. Lesson of Chazal is, Beinkach, we will be moved on in Aman. Klal Yisrael will exist. If we are wise enough to make the Havdalah ourselves, Ba'avdil Eskam and Amin Lios Liliyam, then we'll live comfortably and in tranquility with the Rabbeinu Shalom. When we lose perspective of that, that's when we open the door to all the difficulties, all the anguish of the Golus. That's what we need to remember. What we need to remember is that our survival in the Golus is exactly dependent on the Abdul Eskham and Amen Lios Liliyam. I often, Purim time, reflect on events surrounding the Holocaust, which I don't want to talk about now. Only because I ask myself at times the question of why in the 20th century we were not spared from the Haman of our era. That's a question for a different day. But that's what Purim time, my mind often turns in that direction. But one thing that we need to learn from the events which surrounded it is that it made no difference in the trauma of the events of the Holocaust if a person was a pious Jew or if a person was the most assimilated and even converted to a different religion. The historic fate of the Jewish people was shared equally by all. That's what the Rabbanu Shalom tells us, Abdul Eskim and Amim Lios Liliyam. We are forewarned that we cannot hide. We have an identity as Jews, and we will not succeed in hiding that identity and disappearing from the world. The world will be more than anxious to remind us of it. It's to the contrary, we should proclaim it with great pride and with great dignity. Our association with the Rabbeinu Shalom, and the Rabbeinu Shalom has assured us that in matem of dolim min ha'amen, harei atem shalom.